welcome to this episode of Pause with Nandini on NRI Affairs. To introduce my next guest, I am going to read a little bit of the blurb of his new book. Expansion of Islam in India is something that has divided historians. While there are many who claim that Islam spread in the Indian subcontinent by force and sword, the contending opinion suggests that Islam spread by peaceful means through merchants and Sufis. In this context, Syed Ubaidur Rahman's latest work, based on rigorous research and using primary sources, is of immense importance as it dissects the false notion of forced conversions across much of India, especially South India. Peaceful expansion of Islam in India from Kerala to Kashmir fills a major gap in the history of Islam in India. No student of Islam in this region can afford to ignore this highly original, very well documented, and flawlessly written book. After such a great introduction, I'm sure all of my guests are very eager to hear what you have to say. And welcome to our show. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I'll do a little introduction of yours beyond what I just read. Syed Ubaidur Rahman is a New Delhi-based author. He has written extensively on medieval and modern Indian history. His latest book is Peaceful Expansion of Islam in India, which I just read a little bit about. Other recent publications include Forgotten Muslim Empires of South India. We'll ask him to talk a little bit about that. There's a biographical encyclopedia of Indian Muslim freedom fighters. And he has also written another book. He's written op-eds for leading Indian and foreign newspapers, including Hindustan Times, Economic Times, The Quint, etc. Let's get right to it. At a time when the mainstream narrative is primarily focused on the violence and the barbarity associated with the Mughal rule, your new book seems to be challenging the narrative. And this narrative is set not just in academia, but also through film and popular mediums. Talk to us a little bit about the genesis of the book, how it came to you, and what it seeks to establish and question. And then maybe we can talk a little bit about the evidence that you have researched to support your book.
I mean, the genesis of this book, as you said, is not new. In fact, I wanted to do it for, say, a decade now, almost 10 or 12 years. And actually, there is a perception within almost not just local fellows, but even very educated, well-read people, including historians too, that while talking about Islam in India, we tend to believe that Islam came through hordes of, say, swarming soldiers, cavalry riding on huge Arabian horses who came and conquered first Sindh, then Punjab, then came to Delhi, and then scattered to towards what we call Bengal, and then went all the way from Gujarat to Deccan and Tamil Nadu. This is a perception that has been sort of fed so much about and has been talked so much about that even educated Muslims, historians, they all tend to believe this in this narrative. But when we talk about arrival of Islam in Delhi, the Delhi Sultanate was established in India, in Delhi, around, say, in early 13th century. And if we talk about Islam in India, then we shouldn't begin by talking about Islam from Delhi or from Lahore. We should talk about from Malappuram, from Cochin, from Calicut. I mean, these were areas where Islam came in, say, late 7th century. And not just this, I'm talking about Malabar. Masudi, a renowned historian, and it has been believed by almost all the historians of medieval India that there were Muslims in 8th century in Gujarat, in Maharashtra, in Konkan, in Tamil Nadu, and also Bengal. So when we should talk about Islam in India, we should begin not from south, not from north, but from south. And Masudi also writes. Masudi was not just a historian, but he was an explorer who traveled across the world. I mean, known world at the time, from China to India and much of say Southeast Asia. So he was in India, and while writing about Muslims' presence in Gujarat, he says that Balhara kings of the time, the people who ruled at Gujarat and the surrounding places at the time, they loved Muslims. And he says that in different parts of Gujarat at the time, there were Muslim habitations where at least around 10,000 Muslims are living in 8th century. I'm not talking about, say, 13th or 14th century Delhi. I'm talking about Gujarat. The same was true about Malabar, Kerala. So in Kerala also there were large number of Muslims beginning. I mean, the King Cheraman Perumal's conversion about Islam is a very common sort of thing. And we all know that the first mosque that was built in India was not in Delhi or in Lahore, but in Malabar. And recent sort of excavations have sort of proved it beyond doubt that in Gujarat, the oldest mosque is in India is in Gujarat, that was built in very early period of Islam. So where actually while praying, Muslims actually they sort of face Kaaba, Makkah. But that mosque had its sort of front towards Jerusalem. So Jerusalem was the first place, or the mosque in Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Initially, Muslims prayed towards it. So the mosque that was excavated recently and found intact in Gujarat, I'm just forgetting the name of the city, it has its sort of it's facing not Mecca but Quds in Jerusalem.
That tells you how old it is.
Exactly, yeah. So I mean, this changes the whole hypothesis of Islam sort of being whispered through sort of power and sword. I mean, I'm not denying that there were forcible conversion. I mean, this has such a long history Muslims have in India. I mean, Islam is as old in India as Islam is itself, because it's Muslims started coming to India during the lifetime of prophets. It is not because Muslims started invading India, but because Arabs, they had long-standing trade relationship, mercantile relationship with India. They had been coming, not just Muslims, the Romans, the Persians, the Arabs, all the trading communities, they were coming to that part of the world. I mean, Coromandel and this Malabar. So when Islam, the Arabs converted to Islam, they started, I mean, the same, I mean, Arab were the same. Now they were Muslims. So if they are going to Southeast Asia, they were carrying their own identity, their own religion, I mean, their own traditions. So the same, it was natural.
When you say that it came first to the south, then do you mean it was more maritime, like they all came by boats or ships or whatever? That's how they
Exactly.
the south first. So they didn't come through the passes in the north.
Not at all, not at all. There is one very important difference between the Muslims coming through northern passes, through Afghanistan and sort of Khyber Pass and all the passes that we have heard about. The Muslims coming through north, they are usually Hanafi Muslims who follow Hanafi traditions of Islam. And the Muslims who came through sea, I mean, who were Arabs direct, the Muslims coming through north were not Arabs. They were Turkish, they were Afghanistan, they were Iranians, and all sorts of Central Asian ethnicities. But the people coming through sea to either it is Coromandel or say Tamil Nadu or Kerala or Gujarat, they were all say they were Shafi. So Shafi traditions in Muslims in Malabar, Muslims in Tamil Nadu, most often they would be found to be following Shafi'i traditions, and Muslims coming from north, they are following these Hanafi traditions. So in north we have Hanafi in majority and Shafi'i and Maliki in South India. I mean, for common people it may be hard, but if I'm talking about history and historiography, I mean, we should, this distinguishes and establishes the fact that the people coming to south, they were not the same people coming from north.
That's very interesting. Tell me a little bit about the research that went into this book.
I mean, all the sources. And you see, if we are talking about Islam's arrival in Kerala, Tamil Nadu, the written history in Malabar is not very old. Like, I mean, we know about sort of North India also, because we did not have this traditional writing of history as sort of as pastime of our authors. I mean, this was, as Abraham Early, he has written in his book, one of his books, that I mean, we were more into long story like Ramayana and Mahabharata.
Right.
So when Muslims came, they started bringing their own historians. He had court historian. So this was not a tradition that was followed by earlier rulers, be it say Buddhist or Hindus. So we see that Kerala's Malabar's history hasn't been sort of written earlier. So the oldest account of the Muslims in Kerala or the Kerala history is itself, I mean, hasn't been preserved much. So the oldest account of Malabari Muslim writing about Malabar was Sheikh Zainuddin. Sheikh Zainuddin wrote in his account in early 16th or late 15th century. He was a local sort of nobleman who was associated with Makhtum family. He's a renowned family of Kerala who had, the entire family had sort of come from outside and had said, sort of established there. And they still remain very notable family up there. So he has written a book, Tohfatul Mujahideen. Then Barbosa is another important source on sort of history of Kerala. And he has written in detail about all the arrivals of people, arrival of not just Muslims, but also Portuguese in that part, and how Muslims tend to sort of establish themselves in the region, and how they started sort of becoming not just embedded in the local population, but how they sort of started commanding a very important position in, say, Malayali society. So Muslims, because they were not small-time merchants. The merchants, like the huge armada they brought, I mean, the fleet of ships that they brought,
right, filled right.
with business communities. So they were, I mean, huge, big merchants who had lots of resources. So like the big businesses as we have, as all the sort of governments, they want to have good relationship with them because of our economic sort of dependence on them. The same was true at the time. So the big businessmen who came to Kerala from Saudi, from Arabia, they actually had influence on the king, local king, Zamorin, who was at the time the king of Malabar. And it was, Zamorin was a title of the king. So all his sons and then grandsons and all those, the kings who took that position, they were called Zamorins. And amazingly, what happened, and I'm not talking about, say, Makhtum, I wrote, but Barbosa has written, and it has been sort of almost well established, that there was, in especially in Malabar, because of Brahmanic traditions of purity, the upper caste people were not allowed to go in the sea. And lower caste people, they were not allowed to mingle with upper caste people. So there was a problem. Problem was that because when ships came laden with sort of all goods that had to be carried to market, the upper caste people wouldn't go to fetch them, to carry them. And local caste people, especially the fishermen, fishing people belong to fishing communities, they were not allowed to take those to the market, because then they'll come. So what happened? It is said, it is written by Barbosa himself, that the king asked people belonging to different communities, especially the lower caste people, to convert one or two of their members to Islam. This is true. And nobody has contested this account. So, I mean, this way Islam is spread in Kerala. And another important aspect, if we talk about, say, the creation of a new kingdom or a new sultanate or a new sort of Badshahi, we think that it is only possible through use of sword because nobody allows to sort of create a new kingdom. But in Kerala, we had a Muslim kingdom, Arakkal Muslim kingdom, that was sort of started because of a love affair between a Hindu princess and a Muslim merchant. And it survived for close to 700 years.
Wow.
Arakkal, yeah, I mean, this is true. This is the tradition of our country. Another important thing, we think that Muslims, I mean, when we have common narratives that Muslims came to North India in 13th century in Delhi. But in Goa, in 10th century, we had at least two Muslim governors. In 12th century, we had in Tamil Nadu, the Pandya king had appointed his prime minister a Muslim. And this gentleman, he remained Muslim, the prime minister, not just during the reign of that particular king, but also the person who inherited the kingdom from him. And at the time in Tamil Nadu, at least in coastal cities, Muslims were very prosperous at them because they were, most of them were traders. So trading was one of the most important things that Islam brought Islam to all those coastal places.
But, you know, when you're telling me this, it feels like nothing really changes because commerce drove the world then and commerce drives the world now. And all the things about religion and all of this are used very conveniently when needed, and we find solutions around them when needed. So that's very interesting. Now, what I found, okay, so let's just go back to the fact that your background is history, and you decided to explore these topics, which somehow are all related in a way. All your books have some sort of a common theme, which is challenging the mainstream narrative, right? So tell me a little bit about your own background and when this started forming in your head. Is it when you were reading the history books in school and college and you found something was not adding up? Or was it just your own curiosity that led you in this journey? How did that happen?
I'll talk about this myself a bit later. I mean, I have to sort of include another aspect also. I will talk about that.
Okay.
That is the arrival of Muslim Sufis. When we talk about, say, arrival of Islam in India, so trade was one aspect.
Yes.
Another very important aspect was Sufis. Muslim Sufis, from very initial periods, they started coming to India because they wanted to sort of take residence in those places where they could feel sort of peace, where nobody could disturb them. So a large number of Sufis, they came. And there is a tradition that, I mean, Nathar Wali Shah, he came to Tamil Nadu in 10th century. And if you have heard about, say, A.R. Rahman, you know, everybody must be knowing that he actually belonged to a non-Muslim family. And his mother went to a Sufi shrine where she prayed for that if somebody is in her family, if he recovers, he was ill, somebody was ill, then she will convert to that Sufi's religion. So that tradition is not new. It was old from 10th century. And another important, when we think that when we talk about conversion, especially of kings, we think that all of them were defeated by Muslim invading Muslim armies. So, I mean, it's not true, it's not wrong that a number of Muslim armies came and they conquered different places and They might have also committed some atrocities. I mean, I don't, it was a medieval period, it is still sort of happening. So that may be true. But if I'm talking about another extreme point of India, from I was talking about Kerala, now I am talking about Kashmir. If you talk about Kashmir, you will never think of, say, Islam coming to that region through Sufis. But I mean, a number of Muslim kings had tried to take control of Kashmir till, say, 13th century. And some people from Delhi Sultanate, they had also attacked. But because of its locations, it was not possible. But what happened in 14th century, 1326 or 30, around 30, for some time, around 3-4 years, there was a Buddhist king who took control of Kashmir kingdom. And he was very curious because at that time, merely a few decades earlier, Mongols had attacked that region and they had plundered it, defeating all the kings there and taking, destroying, because Mongols, they destroyed everything wherever they went, all cities, all towns, and enslaved a large number of people. So he had a sort of curiosity and his own, because due to, I mean, unknown reasons, the local, his own people, the Buddhist or the Hindu priest, they were not able to convince himself, him, about what to do and how to sort of take control of things. So, I mean, he was so much disappointed that he said that whoever I see tomorrow, at first sight, I'll convert to his religion. So when he went to his window, I mean, it was a medieval period and we have been sort of accustomed to such stories. So it wouldn't come as a surprise to one Rinchen Shah, was his name. He went there and saw a Muslim Sufi sort of praying at dawn and pre-dawn prayer. So he invited him to his palace. It's very, very well documented. I mean, it's not hearsay, it's truth. And then for quite a few days, they had discussion about religion and somehow he got convinced that, I mean, I should embrace. So a Sufi, a very, very, I mean, common Sufi, I mean, he was a renowned person, but he did not sort of look like a emperor or like somebody, a noble. So the king converted to Islam. And this way Islam started spreading in Kashmir. Earlier, we don't find any mention of Muslim sort of having any sort of fief or ruling any part of the state, the region at the time. No. Muslims were there. Some kings had employed Muslim soldiers there because they were afraid of Mongols and wanted to protect them. So they, Muslim soldiers were there, some Muslim soldiers. But it was the first time that a Muslim, king accepted religion, and then afterward Islam became part of the sort of Kashmir land. But then again, this was not sudden conversion of the common people. It took centuries before
right.
the it was easy. I mean, it was not it was a rather slow process. And Richard Eaton has written in detail about how it happened, about influence of Sufis across India. So we find that in Lahore, Data Sahab's Darbar, the non-Sufi, 11 Jat families, Jat tribes, they got converted at his hands. And then the same happened in Delhi, in different places. We know that in when this there's a renowned Sufi in Gulbarga. Gulbarga was seat of power of Bahmani Empire at the time. It was a Muslim kingdom in established in early 14th century in, that was founded in Gulbarga. Later, they changed their sort of capital to Bidar. But in Gulbarga, when the Sufi went, Gaisudraz, yeah, sorry, I was forgetting his name. Gaisudraz is a good, great Sufi saint. So a large number of sort of local people, they converted in his hand. So this is a very known tradition of Sufis converting to sort of a large number of people, local people. Because, I mean, we know that there were caste barriers within our society at the time. And among hospices of those Khanqah of Sufis, there was no difference. The Sufi, he slept with them, the locals. I mean, the chief Sufi, Hujveri, the Data Sahab, who's the guy is in, I was talking about in Lahore, he slept in a hall, huge hall, with all thousands of his followers.
Revolutionary for that time, when there were so many stratifications based on caste. So this was something very different, obviously. And obviously, it would have had an impact. But having said that, you know, the narrative, of course, we've all grown up with. And I don't know, you know, how much of that is true. But then there is a lot of violence that is associated with the, as you call it, with the Delhi Sultanate or with different Mughal rulers, where temples, you know, when you go into some of those old temples, you see like the figurines or the idols, you know, the nose will be cut off. Or some, you know, they've basically been vandalized, right? And to this point, I know that people have said that those were the times. It was the medieval times. This is how tribes fought. This is how expansion happened. It wasn't so much religion. It was, you know, any king who's expanding his kingdom or is trying to conquer the neighboring kingdom, there was a certain aspect of violence and domination in there. So what is your take on that? Because, of course, you're talking about the softer ways in which there was an expansion. And I don't dispute that at all. But at the same time, do you think that as it was the norm in those times, some of those things that people today are talking about, the violence, and is that a fair sort of an estimate of how things happened?
I mean, I wouldn't deny that there were violence. I said earlier that there was violence. But violence was not directed against a particular religion. For example, if we take the example of Aurangzeb, the greatest Mughal emperor, I mean, as far as the region is concerned, because he ruled from Kabul to Tamil Nadu, the farthest part of Tamil Nadu, entire. And at that, I mean, in known history of our subcontinent, he was the person, he was the king who ruled over the largest geographical area. So he fought against Shivaji. We tend to believe that he fought against Shivaji. Yes, that was true. But Shivaji was, at that time, he was just an upstart. He was a small, I mean, sort of land owner in Pune, who was trying to expand his fame. Around the same time in South India, you know, just sort of, think about it. There were three very sort of prosperous Muslim sultanates. Bijapur, Golconda, and Bijapur and Golconda. And there were some smaller also, but these were very important sort of kingdoms. So Bijapur and Golconda and Ahmednagar that sort of came to cease to exist around 1630s. Much before Aurangzeb came to power, they had defeated the king of Vijayanagar. And Bijapur and Golconda had sort of taken over almost all the regions that was earlier ruled by Vijayanagar kingdom. So Aurangzeb led an insistent war against Golconda, against Bijapur. And we know that this Bijapur's Adil Shahi kings or sultans, they were Muslims, they had employed Shivaji's father, Shahji. Shahji was a general of not a Maratha kingdom, but he was a general of a Muslim kingdom, Muslim sultanate. Aurangzeb fought against Muslim kingdoms much more viciously, much more aggressively, because they were powerful and they ruled a substantial part of South India. So Bijapur kings, they are known as Adil Shahi sultans were the rulers who ruled over much of Karnataka, much of Tamil Nadu at the time. And as far as Bijapur fort is concerned, Mughals in 1686, they laid siege to that fort, and king himself went there and stayed for, say, 8 months. The same happened in case of Golconda or Hyderabad. Aurangzeb, despite the fact that Shah Jahan had made a sort of commitment with the local king that they would not touch them, Aurangzeb went there and sort of besieged it and sort of continued the siege till it submitted somehow or the other. And there was huge devastation. So Shivaji at that time was not as big, because we know, I mean, if you have read the history or if somebody has known the history, they will realize that Shivaji's fief, Pune, was given, assigned to his father, by Bijapur Sultan. So they were a feudatory of Bijapur. So they were very small at the time, but they were trying to expand. Aurangzeb, what he did, he allowed them to grow by weakening those Muslim sultanates.
It was all strategic.
Yes, and it was not because of religion. Might be religion has played some part, but if we talk about Maratha-Mughal war, we'll see that Rajput generals, they were mainly responsible for taking on Marathas. Mughals, yani Mughal princes, they were not going there. They may be part of the armies, but main generals who were leading were Rajputs. So this was actually different thing. If we sort of talk about them in our period, civilizational period, when we have a lot of changes, human rights, improvement and all those things, I mean, we will find that very sort of disappointing. And I'm no fan of Aurangzeb. But I think that what happened at the time was, actually, if it was not Aurangzeb, somebody else might have done it. And as far as, I mean, Marathas are concerned, if you read history, if you read how they invaded Bengal and earlier the Odisha, the devastation they caused within the Hindu regions, I mean, it is an eye-opener.
Marathas, when they went to Odisha, and
went to Bengal, yes. And also again, I mean, the king at the time in medieval period wanted to have all the power in his hand. So he wanted to, even if Muslim, they would go and attack. Because Mughals, when they came, India was not in the hands of Hindus. In Delhi, he fought against Ibrahim Lodi. Mughals came, he went to Gujarat, they fought against Gujarat Sultanate, that was Muslim Sultanate. They went to Malwa, there was a Khilji king at the time, they fought against him. They again sort of went to Ahmednagar, destroyed Ahmednagar. It was against sort of ruled by Muslim. They went to Hyderabad, they destroyed Golconda, that was against the Qutub Shahi Sultanate. They went to Bijapur, that had control of almost Kannada area, and then Tamil area, that was ruled by Muslims. So when they came, they attacked Muslim sultanates, not Hindu sultanates. And if there were some small kingdoms also, they also attacked them. They wouldn't spare anybody.
Why has all of this disappeared from our history books and from the public discourse?
I think that much of that was during, has to be done, has to do with how British actually wrote about history. They had an interest in destroying the Hindu-Muslim harmony that had remained the same till 1857. They had seen that if Muslims and Hindus, they are together, it will be very hard for them to rule the country peacefully. I mean, so what they did initially after 1857, what they did, they tried to destroy Muslims and appease Hindus. But when Congress, Indian National Congress, and other revolutionary organizations they rose from within the Hindu society in Bengal, in Bombay and other places, then they started pampering Muslims.
Divide and rule philosophy of theirs, which caused a lot of mischief. Great. So we've had a really good discussion about that book. But I also wanted to talk about the Encyclopedia of Indian Muslim Freedom Fighters. A little bit, I wanted to talk about that just because that now, you know, and it's no secret what the atmosphere is in terms of the mainstream narrative, where nationalism has become a very strange kind of a concept, where if you are against anything that's wrong in the country, or if you are against anything that's the popular sort of narrative, you are anti-national and you are, you know, and of course, and if by chance, if it's a Muslim person who's pointing out something that's wrong or something that shouldn't be done, aap to Pakistan chale jaye. So, you know, these ideas have become very polarized and very divisive in our country. And I think somewhere this book of yours, which talks about the Muslim freedom fighters, although in an ideal world, we wouldn't need to refer to people's religion when they're talking about something that's bigger than, you know, your personal faith. But in the circumstances, I think it makes a powerful point that, you know, like they say, the country doesn't just belong to one religion, because not just people from one religion have fought for its freedom. And in that way, I think it's everybody's ownership, it's everybody's responsibility. So tell me a little bit about that book, and what, again, you haven't spoken about your own bit, and you dodged the question and we went off into the Sufis, but maybe, you know, you can combine both of those and talk about your own journey in discovering this and coming to write that book.
This Encyclopedia of Indian Muslim Freedom Fighters is important because of the fact that, I mean, in the present narrative, the world where we live, as you said, that it's not ideal to have a book on, I mean, exclusively focusing on Muslim freedom fighters. Because when it comes to freedom fighters, I put Mahatma Gandhi on top. And I wrote a piece for Sifi some 10 years ago, saying that why Mahatma Gandhi should be called as father of, not just India, father of Indian Muslims. So, I mean, he is among top. But because of the fact that while a lot has been written about Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi and others, I mean, but this aspect of Muslims contributing to the freedom struggle has sort of evaded most of us. I mean, if you go to a bookstore and you sort of try to get a book on freedom fighters, there are chances that if a book is there, you wouldn't find, say, more than 2-3 names in it.
Correct.
Let me begin with, if you talk about Indian National Congress, that was the main and most important part of our freedom struggle. 9 of its presidents were Muslims. 9, not 1 or 2 or 3, 9 were Muslims. And if I ask somebody to name a few, they wouldn't sort of come, they wouldn't name anybody except, say, Maulana Abul Kalam Azad.
That's the most well-known name in all our heads.
Yeah. So there was a need to talk about them. And if we, because there is a narrative within the society that actually Muslims, they fought for Pakistan. And when Pakistan was created, because they fought for Pakistan, they shouldn't be sort of clubbed as freedom fighters. And in my book, I haven't included any name who fought for Pakistan. So, and in fact, within the Muslim society, the large overwhelming segment of our society, Muslim society, was against the formation of Pakistan. The Deobandi ulama who are hounded day and night, Maulana Hussain Ahmad Madni, he wrote especially a book on why Muslims should not support the idea of Pakistan. And he had a very hot discussion with Sir Allama Iqbal, the great poet of East, who wrote Sare Jahan Se Achha Hindustan Wala. So this is very surprising. And then again, Maulana Abul Kalam Azad was himself a great scholar. And the person who brought Hindus and Muslims together was none other, another Deobandi alim scholar, Maulana Sheikhul Hind Mahmudul Hasan. You might have heard about the name of the Reshmi Rumal Tehreek. Reshmi Rumal Tehreek was a freedom struggle that was a movement for freedom struggle that was initiated in say 1915, and two people of that Reshmi Rumal Tehreek, they went on to become the home minister and defense minister of the first provincial government that was formed in Kabul, and Maulana Maulana Bhopali was the first provincial provisional prime minister of India, that in a government that was formed in Kabul, thanks to the efforts of Reshmi Rumal Tehreek. It floundered because the First World War started and things changed across much of the world. So their whole planning sort of was destroyed.
Yes.
But this Sheikhul Hind Hussain Ahmad Madni, Sheikhul Hind this Mahmudul Hassan and Hussain Ahmad Madni and almost a dozen of their supporters, they spent around 3 years in a prison in Malta in Europe.
Wow.
Because of this uprising in Bihar, and the leaders of Muslim leaders from Bihar and UP, they jointly formed an organization, Jamhuri Mahaz, that was aimed at defeating Muslim League and the idea of Pakistan. And nobody knows about them. So when India was divided and partitioned, you see that majority of Muslims, they stayed here. Only the people who were surrounded, lived in sort of Punjab and Haryana, they went. And many of them had actually thought that when things will settle down, actually the two will come together and we'll go back. So, but that never happened. Yes. And I think that, I mean, this was a very primitive or say false idea of creating a separate kingdom for sort of state. And we see that, I mean, several people, Honorable Kalam Azad had predicted that Pakistan will become weak over a period of time and other international powers will sort of misuse for their own advantage. And we see that over the last 75 years, the same has happened. So this actually talks about a number of people who fought not just during the 47 sort of openness movement, but also about 1857 also, when Muslims and Hindus, they fought together. I mean, Nana Sahab's prime minister was Azim Khan. And both fought together. And when this, not just Nana Sahab, Jhansi ki Rani, when she was defeated in her own area, she took refuge in Bareilly, where Muslim Rohila Pathan was ruling at the time. Mm-hmm. And he had sort of revolted. So they all were fighting together to revive India that they had lived in prior to the arrival of the British. And they had sort of anointed, somehow or the other, they had anointed the last Mughal king, Bahadur Shah Zafar, as their leaders. So when the toughest stand that the revolutionaries took in Delhi, there were two groups. One was Ghazis and the other were Rajputs from Rajputana. So they were fighting together for the same heritage they had, for the same liberty they had enjoyed. Right. But somehow, yeah.
This is what is happening now. And we are seeing that this whole revisionist movement where history books are being rewritten and according to whatever the mainstream narrative is beneficial to a certain ideology, those things are there, those things are being expanded, everything else is being taken out. It's it's like making a whole new history out of facts. So as someone who cares about history and who cares about facts, what do you think the impact of that is going to be on our country when a large chunk of who we are and where we've come from is going to be removed from our public consciousness and from the history books for our children? What do you think the impact of that is going to be?
Impact will be catastrophic. But as I think that, I mean, I am very optimistic.
You have seen the rise and fall of many many sultanates and many kings.
Yeah. So I am very optimistic, and I think that whatever a certain people they try to sort of the narrative they try to create, because they are in power and they have sort of all the resources at their disposal. But the common people, the people, the majority of people, they wouldn't buy those things. The even though right now it seems that they are buying and they are following and they are falling for it, but in the long term, I think that things will change, and we shouldn't be that much pessimistic about the future of the country. We have endured a number of things. We have endured the British, and things will change, hopefully, very soon.
I love that. I love that positive attitude, because I feel like if you stop hoping and if you become pessimistic about everything, you can't really, build anything new. You only build something new when you have hope for the future. So thank you for that. That's been really an interesting discussion. Perhaps we'll have to have you back to talk about your journey, which we have very skillfully evaded so far, but that's all right. It's been absolutely wonderful speaking with you, and thank you so much for joining us today.